Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
My lady, that's the moment that everything changed. I thought that there was a burglar that was gaining entry into my home.
That is Oscar Pistorius on the witness stand in his murder trial in Pretoria. For days, the world has been riveted as the double amputee, Paralympic and Olympic athlete, has testified about the death of his girlfriend, model Reva Steenkamp, in what Pistorius says was an accidental shooting in the early morning hours of Valentine's Day 2013. Yesterday, his testimony ended after five dramatic and grueling days of cross-examination. But many attorneys in South Africa, journalists covering the case, and even trial watchers wonder why all the attention, why the sudden massive media spotlight on a country, indeed a continent, that so rarely gets any press attention overseas at all, and why no discussion of the one issue that is clearly at the center of the case. Well, joining us now to answer those questions and help get a little perspective from South Africa, award-winning journalist and author Margie Arford. And here in the States, attorney Lisa Bloom, who is a legal analyst for Avvo.com and the author of many books, including Suspicion Nation, the inside story of the Trayvon Martin injustice and why we continue to repeat it. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, Margie, I want to get to your piece in The Guardian, which drills down on the real issue in this case that no one is talking about. But first, we do talk so infrequently about Africa at all in other places, the UK, Europe, Asia, Latin America, and especially here in the US. Yes, of course, we all covered Mandela's funeral for a few days, and there is the occasional...
Oh, well done.
There's the occasional.
I'm glad you noticed that event.
That's right. We have the occasional visit by a president, and we give that a little attention. But why the absolute obsession, in your opinion, with Pistorius? Do we have a lack of perspective here?
I think it's a mixture. I mean, Pistorius is a truly famous person with his, you know, the sort of Blade Runner and his amazing performance at the Olympics. So I think wherever he was from, he would be covered, you know, in this gruesome and melodramatic case that he's involved in. So the coverage of it is natural in a way. But what has struck me, I've been following the international press, is that, and people have been interviewing me about this, is looking more and more to this case to give them some kind of keyhole into understanding what has happened in South Africa. I mean, South Africa is still, even though it's kind of dropped off the news radar, was for so many decades a kind of touchstone of people's conscience, whether you were racist or not, whether you were progressive or not. You could tell it around how a non-South African reacted to apartheid. So I think part of it is that. And it, I mean, it is such a, I mean, I think it's a bit like O.J. Simpson meets the Kardashians. It's so spectacular, the whole thing. You know, this fallen Olympic hero. And then, of course, the strangeness of South Africa with its miracle transition, thanks to Mandela and others, and this simultaneous extreme and normalized violence. And what I think, I'm sure we'll talk about it just now, is a very thinly disguised racism that functions still.
Well, let's turn to that, because you've written very specifically and provocatively about that issue. You've been writing about the Pistorius case from the beginning, including a case, a piece that's received a lot of attention for The Guardian called The Oscar Pistorius Trial and the Imaginary Black Stranger at the Heart of the Defense. Now, let's listen to a few seconds of Oscar Pistorius' testimony on direct examination on this very point.
The first thing that ran through my mind was that I needed to arm myself, that I needed to protect Reva and I, that I needed to get my gun. I was scared that the person was going to come out, or people were going to come out.
Now, Margie, you've written, quote, Pistorius has insisted that he thought there was an intruder, an armed and dangerous man intent on robbery, rape, and murder. The figure of the threatening black stranger has driven many black South Africans into fortress-like housing estates surrounded by electric fences, armed guards, and relentless surveillance of security cameras. So, Margie Orford, help us unpack that a little bit. What exactly are you talking about? Do you see a certain racial paranoia as unspoken but paramount in the Pistorius case and the larger society?
It is. I mean, it's mainly white South Africans that have fled into these security estates. Now, crime has, if we can go back 20 years, the whole system of apartheid was sustained, especially for white South Africans, with this relentless creation of the fear of the other, the fear of black people, and that, you know, very obviously, to maintain a system of white supremacy, you needed to somehow persuade people that black people were intruders in their own land. We then had the transition to democracy, and there's two things happened with crime. We do have very high crime rates in certain areas. I've been an investigative journalist for a long time, and I'm a crime writer. I write about this stuff all the time. You have this unbelievable paranoia and feeling of threat, which for much of the time is unrelated to the reality of the facts that people live with. And Pistorius claimed that from the very first moment when people arrived, when the police arrived, his bail hearing, he said, "I was terrified of these intruders." He didn't name them as black, but that is the narrative. That is the discourse that he was drawing on. And nobody said anything. It just seemed to be silently accepted that that was somehow a reasonable response. Now, in that estate where he's lived in and in the area where I live in, there is almost no crime. It's very unusual, and yet you have this Armageddon-like response to what I think is something unexamined and imaginary. I mean, part of what we've seen in the trial, it's kind of getting to who he thought or who he claimed was there, but it's unrelated to facts. It's unrelated to what is actually going on. It's a psychological response. So it's possible he had that paranoid fit. I don't believe it personally, but that's irrelevant. But it's this fear and it's this response of extreme aggression to an unexamined thing, which is extremely dangerous. It endangers all of us because you get this trigger, hair trigger response all the time.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. We're talking about some of the issues that have not been talked about in the Oscar Pistorius case in South Africa. My guests are journalists and authors Margie Orford in South Africa and Lisa Bloom here in the United States. And Lisa Bloom, let me turn to you, because in addition to your book Suspicion Nation, which is very much about the same kinds of issues Margie Orford is talking about, I hear her use that word unexamined, and it makes me think very much about Suspicion Nation. But you now also have a piece on Avvo.com aptly titled Fearing Fear Itself, which picks up on that same theme, and you posit that this kind of defense, the Pistorius defense, is not uniquely South African. Say some more about that.
Well, that's right. So fear is what underlies the Oscar Pistorius case, if you believe his story. Fear is what underlied the George Zimmerman shooting of Trayvon Martin, if you believe his story. Fear was the basis of Michael Dunn's shooting of Jordan Davis in Florida. That was called the Loud Music murder case, if you believe his story. And so we see this defense over and over again. When someone shoots an unarmed person and is later held accountable for it, they say, "Well, I was afraid. I'm afraid of crime," right? And that's just sort of taken at face value. And like Margie, I wanted to go after that a little bit. In my book, Suspicion Nation, you know, I had devote a large amount of time and effort to this issue that really our fears of crime are overblown, certainly in the United States, where crime is down very significantly, down to 1960s levels all across the country, down 60-something percent in major cities, and especially down in the South, where we've seen a number of these shootings. And in the United States, as in South Africa, so often this fear is really code for fear of the black man as criminal. And we saw that in the George Zimmerman case, the Michael Dunn case. And I agree with Margie that that's clearly at play in the Oscar Pistorius case, even though he didn't say that. I've spent time in South Africa. I've experienced that. I've had people tell me that they're just so afraid of the black criminal. And, you know, it's so not only offensive for somebody like Oscar Pistorius, who lived in a safe area, but it's really a problem there as here. And I think we have to drill down on that particular issue and call it out for what it is. It's irrational, it's offensive, and it's unreasonable.
Well, in fact, in Oscar Pistorius's housing development, the first crime committed there was this crime. And you know, whether he's guilty or not, the shooting death of this woman is the first homicide ever in that development. And Lisa, to your point, homicide isn't even in the top 10 causes of death for Americans, which you point out in your piece on avo.com. But Americans still, Lisa, remain deeply apprehensive about crime, which is out of proportion with the real chances of its effect on the lives, especially of white, middle, and upper middle class Americans. So we can talk about that, but what can we do about it?
Well, I think, you know, like the 12 steppers say, the first step is acknowledging that you have a problem, right? And so in my book, I go through the top 10 causes of death for Americans, according to the CDC, and homicide is not even on the list. If you want to fear America's most prolific killer, fear cheeseburgers, because heart disease is the number one killer of Americans. You know, we should be more concerned about slippery surfaces in our home, because accidents in the home is on the list. We should be looking inward at ourselves and at our homes instead of outward at these imaginary criminals who really pose very little threat to us. And, you know, the racial angle is also very important, because the statistics just don't bear out this persistent, toxic fear of the black man as criminal. I, for example, as a white woman living in the suburbs in Los Angeles, if I'm victimized by a criminal, it's six times as likely to be by a white person than by a black person. George Zimmerman, when he got out of his car that night in Sanford, Florida, was more likely to be hit by lightning than to be victimized by Trayvon Martin.
Is that true, Lisa?
I think we need to become aware.
The lightning statistic?
Yes, everything I'm saying is true and very carefully researched, and I have hundreds of footnotes in my books to back it up.
I ask you about the lightning because I have a tweet that suggests the lightning statistic is hyperbole. But in terms of white women, are they not more likely to be victimized by someone they know than by a black stranger?
Well, first of all, it's not hyperbole. I reviewed the data very, very carefully and even had a math professor, a college math professor, review the numbers to check my work on that one. So it's absolutely true. And, you know, the only reason why somebody would think it was hyperbole is because we have this overblown fear of the black man as criminal. We do have a lot of African-American men in prison in the United States, but that's largely due to the grossly disproportionate policing in black neighborhoods. And because of the war on drugs, where, you know, blacks are four times as likely, for example, to be arrested and incarcerated for marijuana possession than whites, even though both groups use at about the same rates. So you can't go by arrest and conviction numbers. You have to go by the numbers of people who are actually committing the crimes. And in America, most crime is intra-racial, white on white, black on black. And as I said, the whole issue of crime is overblown to begin with. We see a lot of these scary stories in the news, but they don't reflect the reality. The crime is way, way down.
I think your quote in your piece on Avo is spot on. Quote, fear is another way of saying we see others as lesser, as unworthy, as deserving of a violent response. And Lisa, I find that deeply troubling because it's been more than 50 years since Emmett Till died. And the men who murdered him got away with it. And yet you're positing that we still view some Americans as less worthy than others in our criminal justice system. And in your book, you suggest other institutions as well.
So in the book, I refer to a study where subjects are given an article to read about crime. They are then asked to draw a picture of the perpetrator. There's no picture or race description given in the article. Most of the subjects see a black male when they're just told about crime, even though the race was never given. I mean, there's just study after study showing how deeply embedded the black male as criminal stereotype is in our psyche. And this goes way back to the days of slavery, of Jim Crow, and unfortunately continues to the present day. I believe, for example, in the Trayvon Martin case, that racial profiling was not only part part of George Zimmerman's calculation, but it was present for so many of the participants in the courtroom, the judge, the jury, the attorneys. It was at play just virtually across the board. And I backed that up in the book with stories and analysis and new interviews. This is a problem. The problem, like I said, is not going away until we all face it and decide to eradicate it.
Margie Orford, is this not essentially the same point you're making with your piece? And
absolutely.
I know you've done
that
Oscar Pistorius, even though he didn't kill a black intruder, if he had, he would have been justified in the minds of a majority of white South Africans, even though the law might not necessarily justify a shooting in South Africa. Had the victim been a black man, it might have been justified in the minds of a lot of people. And you've received some Twitter responses to that effect, correct?
Yes, I got a deluge of hate Twitter after my article, because, you know, I think, what was just being said now, the discourse around crime it's sort of sublimated something about race that is generally no longer acceptable to say out loud in public. So there's kind of veneer of that it's criminal and therefore it's justified, and this fear of the other who is given the persona of a black man is then somehow permissible in public. South African law is different to the U.S. law. Pistorius is guilty of murder as much as it had been an intruder. All the Western country can't attack someone, even in your house, unless they're trying literally directly to kill you. But that is the thing that operates, and I think that people would sympathize with somebody who shot somebody in their house, but he would still be guilty of killing somebody unlawfully. That is for sure. But what is interesting about the trial for me and for South Africans, I think, is through that amazing prosecutor Harry Nell. I saw you called him the pit bull. He's just gone at basically unpacking the irrationality of that fear, and that there was no justification. But I think there's something else at play as well in this discourse, and it's about a way of being a man. It's about a way of being masculine. And in a culture, and I've lived in the U.S. for a couple of years, there are many parallels. Armed people who think you can, like, shoot anybody if you feel like it, apart from all the nice ones, and there too. But this feeling that to be a real man, you must think before you act. You must act before you think. You must just respond to anything that you might perceive as a threat. And then, as we've seen Pistorius this whole week, as though that is some kind of justification to be a completely unthinking, unexamined, unreflective person. And there's a nexus between racism and this hypermasculinity, this sort of macho-ness, which is very extreme in South Africa and extremely dangerous. I mean, I'm the patron of rape crisis as well, so I deal a lot with sexual violence. And it's at play in many cases. This one, the spotlight is just on it. But what's been interesting is that because he claimed that as a defense, this sort of putative self-defense thing, there's been none of the usual thing that you see in celebrity trials, especially of men killing women, of that somehow she was guilty of getting herself murdered. That's been a very interesting thing. It's been a trial of this particularly stupid, masculine, prejudiced behavior.
In part because he claims he was defending Reva. That's part of his defense. And so she almost falls out of the storyline as the victim.
Is part of the Ku Klux Klan thing for lynching people in the South, in the States. You know, that you're defending the women. So there's a whole sort of structure of aggression and othering and of how where women should be placed and all sorts of things that plays into that.
Now, not surprisingly, we do have some callers who want to push back a bit on what we're saying, and let's take one of those callers. I have Tedla, who is calling in from Flushing, which is in Queens here in New York. Let's take that call. Tedla, you are on WNYC, and I thank you so much for listening and for your phone call. Please go ahead.
Yes. Good morning, ladies. I mean, for me, this has nothing to do with race. This is just a celebrity trial like O.J. Simpson. We know very well that this was a very well-protected gated community. And the lover, the Blade Runner, he was jealous. He was raged. He just took this lady. That's what he did. The prosecutor caught him. He lied about it. This has nothing to do with race or with anything. This man did not conspire with other people. If he had, he would have brought a young black man, and he could have been victimized by that one. So this is a rage. This is about power. This is about class. So South Africa, in fact, had this been a poor white man killing another white woman, it could not be even a news. So South Africa, they wasted these resources rather than fixing their schools, a lot of infrastructure problem, a lot of black-to-black killing in South Africa. They should have wasted it somewhere else. I don't know why they focused on this trial. It is true. The prosecutor has caught this guy. He killed this lady out of rage, out of jealousy, period. It has nothing to do with race, and we know very well.
Tedla, thank you so much for your call. Margie, let me come to you on that because it brings me to another question, and, you know, this is the debate. Many people think he's guilty. Some think he's innocent. But it does make me ask you a question that I've received from so many people here in the United States, and that is the fact that you don't have a jury system there in South Africa. The judge who is hearing this case with two assessors, be more aware of the subtle issues that you are raising, Margie, than perhaps a jury would? And we've seen this many times here in the United States in the cases that Lisa has raised. Will she be more attuned to the subtleties and the presence of the racial issue in the defense than even Tedla was with his call? Perhaps she should not be.
I mean, I have a great deal of respect for the judge. And as a South African, it's very interesting. If you look at it from outside, if you can see the transformation of this country in 20 years, where you have this incredibly dignified, astute black woman presiding over three of probably the most aggressive and noisy white upper class men that you can imagine. There's a rather nice irony in that situation. I think that the prosecutor went directly for what we call here femicide, that Pistorius intended to kill his girlfriend. There's a specific crime category for that. That's what they've gone for, which is very interesting. It was, you know, he's using that discourse. But, you know, we had the last jury system here in 1969, so we're all used to having the judge and her two assessors. And usually the judges, in my view, give a far more balanced judgment in response to the evidence that's presented to them, because they've seen hundreds of autopsy pictures, lots of blood, all sorts of, you know, the antics and performance that Pistorius has put on. So in some ways you get a more measured judgment around the evidence rather than swaying people around opinion and kind of feeling of it. But it is also what I'm used to. There's a whole procedure where they can go and appeal and will go to other judges, but I think he will get the clearest verdict from a judge with her two assessors.
And Lisa
Jamie,
Bloom,
can I jump
yes,
in on
I
that?
Want to give you an opportunity, you may, and also what you think the lessons of this case, bigger than just the case, because I think the only value in watching these things is if we can learn a larger life lesson. Are there any lessons for us in the United States in watching this case?
Thank you. So, you know, I'm going to leave to Margie in South Africa the more subtle issue of race in the Pistorius case. I think she makes a powerful argument that it is present through Oscar Pistorius's overblown fear. I talk in my book, Suspicion Nation, about the George Zimmerman case, which, like your caller, many people said, oh, that was not about race. People were very insistent that they didn't want it to be about race. The problem is that the defense in that case very clearly said that it was, because they made an analogy that Trayvon Martin was a match, that was their word, match, to two African-American criminals who had been in that neighborhood 6 months prior. Well, the only match was skin color, although the prosecution never called them on that. I think that was a very clear act of racial profiling in the case. So, I mean, one of the things I try to do in my book is to explain why race not only was so much a part of that case, but how it could have been handled, how it should have been handled in a way that would have been more effective, so that the jurors who ended up saying, well, the case is really not about race, could have understood more deeply what was really going on. I don't think shying away from the issue does us any good. I get accused, I'm sure Margie probably does too, anybody who talks about race gets accused of race baiting or playing the race card. But I think we have to get past that and understand how very deeply there are roots of some, you know, really disturbing, deep-seated problems that have been going on in America for a long time, in the Zimmerman case and the Michael Dunn case. And I think Margie makes a very good case that this was part of the Oscar Pistorius case as well. The lesson for all of us is to really stop living in fear, to get past our fears, to get past our suspicions of our neighbors. That's why I call my book Suspicion Nation, because it's not just about Florida. This is a nationwide problem, I think, for us. And perhaps what this Pistorius case teaches us is this is really a problem worldwide, but it's a problem I think we can overcome.
All right. Well, on that, Margie, I'm afraid I'm out of time, but I know that the case has been adjourned for 2 weeks, so perhaps we'll have you back to continue with us when the judge resumes in May. And I thank you so much, author and award-winning journalist Margie Orford in South Africa, and Lisa Bloom, legal analyst for Avvo.com and author of Suspicion Nation. Thank you both for joining me.